So these two things, if you would like to, you can keep them and you can make notes into it, because I thought it will be quite helpful for you to have these outlines, because we will be covering a lot of materials, like in 2 days we have to go through the whole Lamrim. I don't know if any of you have been to Tushita, that at least you have 7 days to go through the whole Lamrim, which is still nothing. But it gives you, especially for the people who are new, it gives you some kind of idea what this is all about, how, you know, what kind of mental factors or what kind of attitudes one needs to develop in order to go to the next stage. And it doesn't mean that you stay then with the first topic and then you don't go on until you realize that. In a way, what is happening here is like, maybe you get, if you never heard about Buddhism, then you get in, you meet a new restaurant of a country that you've never eaten the food from. So you go in and then you look at the menu. Yeah, you're not getting stuck at the first dish and want to know exactly what this is all about and all this. You look like at all the dishes. And then when you know, okay, that is available and all this, then maybe you go back to one and you make a choice. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, one then practices these topics, isolated one from the other. It always goes together. But by knowing like the whole path, but in a very, very, please be realistic, okay? In a very, very superficial way, at least you know when you go further on, when you go to teachings, you will know where to fit them in, okay? And I will talk tomorrow a little bit about the structure of the path and why this has been, I mean, this is not the only Buddhist path. There's many paths. This path called Lamrim, like the graduated stages to enlightenment. So to know the structure of this path is quite important, and it will help you further on, you know. And I mean, many of these topics are kind of common sense, so one thinks, oh, you know, I've realized it, I've understood it. But then every time you hear it, or as you go along and you hear it and you think about those things, you discuss it with others, it's very important. And then you meditate on it, it seems that you go, that the understanding of the whole thing changes, yeah. And don't worry so much. As I said, I will give you a lot of material. Whatever you don't get, whatever you don't understand, it doesn't really matter, because after, you know, it would be a total illusion to think that after these few days you can then go off and practice Buddhism without having to need any more teachings, teachers, a sangha, a group where you discuss, where you meet, and so forth, okay? I think one thing that is really, really important, a few things that are really important to know. You don't have to believe anything I'm saying, so don't put yourself under pressure. But you will not convince me that I'm wrong, no matter what arguments you use. I've been practicing this for 24 years. It's very little, by the way, because one talks about lifetimes and lifetimes and lifetimes and lifetimes of practice. And I have come to find this valuable for me and for all my other friends, of course, that I have. Me, from my side, I would not be teaching if nobody asks, because for me it's enough that I study this, I practice this with other people who do the same thing. I'm here because I've been asked to be here, and I'm quite happy to share it. But I don't want to convince anybody that this is the only thing and this is the only path, even though, you know, one has this wish. Remember, when they are well, then they should practice. And, you know, this is personal between me and Giddy from the last course. I was thinking, I'm sure a Christian who is a devout Christian has a view that his is the right path. I wouldn't like it so very much if he comes to me trying to convince me that his is better than mine. So because I said, leave people alone. You know, when they are interested, then they come, they will listen. But in general, one does not go on a mission, yeah? During these 4 days that we will be here, please remember, you have made a decision to come here. Nobody forced you, okay? I mean, it creates great unrest when people leave, but if you really think that you rather leave than to continue to stay here, because it's getting too much and it's boring, or you know, getting upset and it's really not what you want to practice, then by all means, the door is always open, it's not locked. And the more you realize that you're doing this on a voluntarily basis, the more space also you have in the mind. And please, I do not expect from anybody that you accept what I'm saying and you find this is true. If you find it true and helpful and meaningful, fine. If you don't, then just leave it, you know. It's okay? Because you're looking at me like, just maybe for the sitting, these people are sitting against the wall. Try to sit, okay, it's okay to lean against the wall, but still try to sit pretty much like a little bit upright, like not totally as if you're totally bored and just about to go to sleep. It's not very inspiring for me also to see people a little bit lying around. If you cannot sit on the cushion, it's fine. Then just, yeah, we have plenty of chairs, and then just sit on a chair. If you're somebody who likes cold, that would be the area over there. You already told them? Okay. Because I just noticed freezing cold over there. So if you don't like it, you need to come down here. So like this. Also for those people who are against the wall, because we have a lot of mattresses, just take these mattresses and put them against the wall where you're sitting if you need to lean, because much more comfortable than just the bare wall. So that's fine. Okay. In the meditation itself, if you can sit upright, try to sit upright as much as you can, you know, especially the young people. You get used to it, to sit with the free back, and it seems to have an influence on the mind, right? And also there, you're sitting very close together. It's because of the wall, isn't it? Like, yeah. Because if anybody thinks who is sitting there can sit without the wall, because we do have enough space, and you know, we don't need to behave like in a train or a bus at rush hour. It's okay. We can actually make space, which is quite nice. It's good if you're comfortable, but comfortable in a way that it still looks kind of as if you're awake and you know, and okay, like here with me, yeah. And that we can express very often through the body. And also Sogyal Rinpoche said that once in a very, very nice way. He said, like, sit in an inspiring way and then the mind will also get inspired. So it's quite true. The more upright we can sit, the better this becomes. The easier it will be. If you have questions, and I'm sure you will have plenty of questions, then please do not so much ask them while I'm talking, because I'm really good at totally diverting from what I was saying. Might be interesting for the person who is asking the question, but for the others, maybe not so interesting. And since we have to cover a lot of materials, write it down on a piece of paper. In the Moadon, there's this, you know, like these pockets where you can put them in. I'll take them out, or either Giddy gives them to me or something like that. I'll look at them and I see what really needs to be answered. Something that can avoid a lot of questions. The tradition of Buddhism is all about transforming my own mind. For what? For the benefit of others. Now, don't ask me what to do with your mother-in-law or with your children or with your parents who, you know, don't want to practice and all this. Because the more you develop your mind in these two wings of compassion and wisdom, the more you will know what to do. So it's all about this, to really open up the heart, to see that, you know, to really understand on a quite a deep level that we're not getting what we want if we use, you know, greed, desire, attachment, hatred, anger, acting out of irritation, frustration, and so forth. Yes, it's true that if you need somebody to come and fix your lights at home, here in this country, you might need to show anger for the person to come, the electrician. I don't know. Or if you don't want to be cheated when you build a house, it might well be that even not only in this country, also in other countries, you might need to show some kind of strength and force, otherwise the people get lazy and they don't do their job. That's true. But I'm not talking about this, okay? I'm talking about you might show it, and we just talked about this over dinner, that because last course was on patience, and somebody tried it out and it worked. But we're not practicing patience so that the other person does what we want them to do. Because then it's another form of manipulation. Okay? And that very often we do this. And then when they don't do what we want them to do, we get upset and disappointed and all this. Okay? Very often also in the world or in religions, it's all about good and evil. Yeah? So then it's the good that wants to get rid of the evil. Now the problem is if two parties are somewhere in a conflict, each one thinks he is the good one. You know? Nobody says, I'm going to go and fight the good one because I'm the evil one. That's the problem. Yeah, this is why these wars and conflicts are not leading anywhere. So Buddhism is not about good and evil. Buddhism is about stupidity and wisdom. It's the wisdom who is fighting the stupidity. Or, so yeah, I know it's a nice word, it's called about ignorance, but, you know, there's an active ignorance and there's an inactive ignorance. So the inactive ignorance is like, I don't know your name, which is okay. An active ignorance, I think, you know, I'm convinced your name is Judy, okay, which is totally wrong. Like I'm adding something to your combination of body and mind which is totally not there. And this is what our mind is doing. Our conceptual mind from its own side actively adds something to outside phenomena but also to what and who I am. Okay? So that's the stupidity or that's the ignorance. So it's or wrong view. I think I prefer the word wrong view. We're ignorant or we don't know really what brings happiness or well-being, yeah? And this is why we are out of, because we're not aware of that our actions have consequences, and as the Buddha would say, not just in this life, but also in future lives, then we do all kinds of actions. If we would really know it, like if our actions would bring an immediate result, we would have changed our behavior long ago, you know? I mean, I love free fall, but I know if I jump off a cliff, which I would love to do, but then the crashing on the ground, it's not worthwhile. Either I lose my life, which I quite like at the moment, and or I get terribly injured. So this is why the pleasure of jumping off the cliff and having free fall, I have to renounce. And I do this because of wisdom. Because I know it's not worthwhile, okay? So this is this whole thing. I mean, we have what is called worldly ignorance or stupidity or whatever you want to call it. Stupidity is okay, it's not too strong for you. Because I remember somebody got at one point really upset because I said, we're stupid. Do you remember? No, yeah. Yeah, you shouldn't use the word stupid. I said, well, you know, we are stupid, not knowing, ignorant, kind of childish. The Buddha calls us childish people, like children who do things because they think it's a good thing to do right now, but then they don't think of the consequences and they have no power over their mind like that. Okay, so so we're ignorant in worldly facts, like kind of even the worldly happiness we don't know how to produce, or what kind of actions lead to worldly happiness, or what leads to kind of worldly suffering. And then definitely the transworldly stupidity or ignorance is that we, as I said before, we see reality not as it is. Reality appears in a certain way and we believe that this is really true. But when we examine it, we still don't see the reality as it is, but at least we know that what we see is not right. It's not the right way. So this is where it starts, you know. It starts to kind of shake at our very fundamental beliefs. and views and opinions and all that. And you shouldn't take this in just, that makes a lot of sense, it's fantastic, and that. You should really examine how whatever is being said here, how it applies to your life, how it applies to you. Because this is what spiritual practice is for, that it should bring some fruits of, already now, and then, of course, for the future, and fruits of not that you're suffering more that you already do now, but that you become a more relaxed person, or let's say you become more the person that you want, you would like to be. And for that, you need to know how you would want to be. Of course, if you want to be this angry person who's shouting at everybody and everybody is shaking when you come and they all do what you want because they're afraid of you, it's fine, it's your choice, you know. You are free people, basically, you know. I mean, the non-freedom that we have that comes from our wrong views. We would be totally free people. As long as you don't break the law in a country, you can be, getting angry is not breaking the law, so nobody will put you into prison. Your friends might leave you because nobody likes angry people, but you're not breaking the law. So I would rather than not go into this discussion, but anger is a good thing. If you think so, fine, you know. It's fine with me. I let you have all the anger that you want. Even if it's directed at me, as long as it's not physical, it's fine. If it becomes physical, then I try to run away. I can't run fast anymore because of my old body. Okay. But yeah, I mean, you have discussion groups also where you once a day, the first 2 days, where you can discuss these things. Discussion is really, really important. So even though if you think you're such an advanced student and I heard it all these arguments that you yourself had at the beginning also anyway, please go, because go to listen, and one person speaks, the others listen. So it's not really a discussion group, it's more a sharing group, how you view this whole thing, what your views are. Because we can learn a lot, and it really makes a nice... a connection between the people who are doing the same thing as you do. And usually these connections are very, very strong, even though you don't talk much to the other person. I don't know if any of you have been to longer courses, maybe in Copan, Tushita, or like other places, you know, it can be Shechen Monastery or other places. It doesn't always have to be Geluk and FPMT. If you have been with 200 people in a November Copan course, maybe you never talk to the person, but you know, few years down the line, you meet the person and say, "Oh, well, weren't you on that Copan course?" And there's an instant connection, which is good, because what we're doing here, trying to develop the mind from being very selfish, totally not considered about others, being really ignorant of what creates happiness and what creates suffering, and not knowing how reality is, like working with these things is so meaningful, because it will fulfill the wish that we all have to be, you know, whatever qualities you want to have these qualities. And because that's so meaningful, it really makes this very nice connection. So in general, but I'm not saying that you're one of these people, in general, people who come to do these courses, they are people who want to develop a good heart, whatever that means for you. Of course, if you're just here out of curiosity to know what Buddhism has to say, that's also fine. It's no problem. But in general, one uses Buddhism not as a study object, not just, you know, to know what it is, but really to get some tools that you could apply in your life that then will be helpful for you. That's why the Buddha taught. He didn't teach so that people would print his books, or, you know, that they would make these nice altars and make statues and tankas and all this. That's not why he taught. He actually didn't even want to teach, because he said, "What I found is too profound and it might confuse people more than there already are." And so he sat in meditation for quite a while. Not out of selfishness, not out of arrogance, because out of, you know, being kind of being concerned that instead of this being helpful, It might confuse people in such a way that it will get worse with their minds. And it's true, because knowing about absence of inherent existence or emptiness or shunyata, you might totally fall into nihilism and say, well, nothing exists, so therefore, you know, I can do whatever I want. And that's worse. That's worse than believing that things really exist. So, because if we think, you know, if we think that this I, me, we'll talk about this, really exists, at least you want this I, me to be happy. So then you have to nourish that I, me a lot for a long, long time in your practice. Like, for example, practicing the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, the first 3 or 4 perfections to create a lot of positive energy. So that then when the I is really comfortable, then you can discard it, then you can let go of it. Otherwise you fall into a total hole, yeah, if you're not well, if you're not, if you don't know what you are actually, what you're actually dropping. So we take this I along with us for a long, long time on this path. Don't worry about it. You don't have to leave it here. You can still take it home with you. And when I talk about I, I'm talking not talking about this I, but about me. You know, the feeling of me, I that we have. Because that one is wrong.
Ani.
Exactly. That. So that one is, we do have an I, we have a me, we have an I, a conventional I, a name that we give to this combination of body and mind, but we don't have this permanent, independent, existing in and of itself, autonomous, what else words do they use for that thing? Autonomous, permanent, I said, autonomous, unitary, like a one unit kind of thing, I. This one does not exist. It appears like this, but it does not exist. And I'll just start with the spider, so maybe you have a little bit an idea what is being talked about. Because, you see, we have to do all these blah, 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 blah about all these different paths and parts and the karma and presumed rebirth, for what? Just to realize that this I, me, does not exist the way that it appears. But we need all these other methods to be able to come to the point where the mind is ready to take it without falling into a hole. So this is why, like the Buddha gave 84,000 teachings, and he gave 84,000 teachings, and some of them are contradicting. So if you are somebody attached to, but I want the true thing, well, Buddhism is not for you. Because whatever Buddhism can give you that you at the moment will understand is just relative. There's nothing that is really true, what we will be talking about. That's quite frightening, you know. So it's just relative. It depends from which side you look. So this is why also I would ask you, also for you, Israeli people, oh, by the way, those people who don't know me, okay, I come here since, I don't know, 15 years or something. Once a year, and I stay usually 2 months. I would be quite sad if you don't ask me to come anymore, not because I want to teach, but because I like to come. Other people ask me, but why? Other, you know, from other countries. I say, I don't know, you know. But it's quite amazing. The first, I didn't want to come at the beginning. I was frightened of you. Because I knew you from Tushita and from Copan, like the Israelis who come, and I thought, oh, you know, Tushita, I have half of the room full of Israelis, like here is like everybody. So, also I didn't want to outright say, no, no, thank you, I don't want to come, but that was here, it's like this. So I thought, I asked my teacher, and sometimes I was kind of trying to turn the question in such a way that he would understand I didn't want to go, you know. Like Tahiti, I said, ooh, it's so far away, and it costs a lot of money for the group, and the group is very small, maybe they can't pay the ticket. And he said, yeah, it's far away, and it's expensive, and the group is small, but yeah, go and try it out. So also I said, I think I'm not ready to go to Israel, because I haven't taught for many years, also still now, I don't think I am a teacher. So I'm just sitting high up here, but there's no specific reason, just so I can see you, you can see me. So I'm not pretending anything here. So he said, no, it's good, go. So I thought, Anyway, so I went. It was during the Intifada, the second Intifada. I was just about the only tourist in the country at that time. The bus drivers were all extremely nice to me. It got the shock of my life, how nice everybody is in this country. And so, but the moment I set foot here, I felt at home. I don't speak the language, I can't read, or he tried to make me learn to read and just thought, it's not necessary. And I felt at home. I don't really know why. I feel very much at home with the way you do things, with your food, with climate, with so I sometimes it's when I say things, because I say Israelis do this and this and this, it's not to criticize you, it's because I think I know you and maybe you will understand something. And it's not done in a way to put you down and me up. That's definitely not my intention. But I think sometimes it's really funny what you're doing. strange things. You know, we seem to look the same, but we're not the same somehow. And it's all culture. It's all, you know, if you were born in Switzerland and I was born here, it's like, you know, these things we learn from society. But we can unlearn them when we see that they're not helpful and that we don't need them. The problem with the habit is that it becomes true. So once we have a habit, then that's the right thing to do. Or when we have opinions also, you know, my opinion is always right. If somebody has an opposed opinion, that's always wrong. And I might change my opinion, then that changed opinion is right. So it's like, it's all these things that we start to question, you know, what do I believe? And not just out of habit, but really going beyond. And when we talk about learning also in Buddhism, we say a lot of things, but one goes like, first you listen, then you got the wisdom from hearing. So this is why, you know, also your mind, whatever I say, your mind will come, but. Leave that mind alone. Try to listen. You know, by always, you know, when the but comes in, then try to calm your mind down, say, look, come on, shut up. She said you didn't have to believe everything, so don't worry, I'm not believing it, I'm just listening. Okay, so you can calm that mind down a little bit, who wants to say something contrary. So you get the wisdom from hearing, which is not such a bad wisdom. The only thing is, it's quite shallow, it's not really profound. It doesn't really help you change your habits yet. It can actually be a hindrance when you have a lot of arrogance and you think you're really good and you can do everything just like that. So if you have a bit low self-confidence, that's quite helpful in this case, that you think, well, okay, I know it, but it's difficult to really transform. Because if you think you can stop there by just intellectually knowing things, it's like thinking you can drive a car by just, you know, watching a video and then you've never been really sitting there. Yeah, but still you need to know the theory before you start driving the car. So that's the wisdom that comes from hearing. And you can then weigh it up. What do I want? What do I believe? What do I don't believe? And so on. Usually when it comes to beliefs, we don't know, you know, like it's just a belief, it's a view, but is it right, is it not right, we don't really know. So when you have doubts coming up, this is very helpful for your practice, doubts, yeah. But don't just sit with them, because otherwise you're in hell, because you're just doubting, and you can never make steps, forward or backward or left, right, wherever you want to go. But work with the doubt by going like, okay, if I adapt it, this view, it's just a view. And it's not absolute truth, it's just a view, yeah? So if I adapt it, what will change in my life? Will the way I'm starting to behave and seeing things, will it be helpful or will it be harmful? Yeah? And you try to go a little bit long term, not just short term. Okay? So this is usually how you work with doubts. What's the benefit and what's the disadvantage of adapting that view, yeah? And, you know, if you hear this for the first time, like what Buddha said, or what Buddhist teachings are all about, it might turn your own beliefs totally upside down, so don't throw them all out. Really check, you know, the beliefs I had until now, Was it helpful? Did it really make me the person I want to be, or was it even not helpful? And do I want to start working with that? And then the next step would be contemplation. Look, you contemplate, you think about these things, that things you heard, you think about these things. Then you get, this is then, you get the wisdom from using your intellect, which is good, but still not deep enough. And then the third kind of wisdom, the third activity that you do is like meditation, to familiarize your mind with these views again and again and again and again and again until the habit is kind of changed. And for those, I know a few people have been practicing since quite a while. Is that easy? Is it quick? Is it easy to do? Is it fast? Is it, you know, instant? Okay, Kitty says no. I think you heard from his talk that he knows what he's talking about. So, yeah. And I hope he told you also, this is all up to you. Whether you want to, whether you're going to transform your mind or not is really up to you, up to nobody else. And so you, if you want to transform your mind, you need these three steps, like listening, contemplating. Leora will, and me will, in kind of contemplative kind of meditations, we will help you to ask yourselves the right question so that you can maybe sit with the question or find the answer. And then when you have it all ready, when you have the whole, the teachings really there, then, and you can do this, the meditation on yourself, then it becomes analytical meditation, that you go through these points again and again and again and again and again, and until you feel that your behavior changes. And it won't change from one day to the other, it will be gradually. And so therefore, you know, sometimes check back, you know, how was I 10 years ago and or 2 years ago, and how am I now? Like from yesterday to today, unfortunately nothing drastic would happen. If it would, then we would have to rent the football stadium, because there would be so many people coming wanting to listening to that. If it would be easy, quick, and, you know, not costing a lot of money. That's the good thing. Doesn't cost a lot of money. You can give however much you want at the end of the course. It's, I really, really admire the group that they still have the courage to do that, because it needs courage to do that, to ask people to give whatever they feel like they want to give. It works, which is really amazing. We should have the whole society like this. You know, the sign for me that we are a perverse society is that somebody who is earning, I can only talk in euro or in francs, somebody is earning, I don't know, 15,000 euro a month, and somebody who is earning 2,000 or 3,000 a month, they have to pay the same price for the bread. I mean, how can that be right? Isn't it? I mean, it's like there must be something that is not quite right here. So this is what we're trying to do here, that people have a lot of money, then you give a lot. So like this, you can, you create a lot of positive karma. You'll be rich again in your next life. This is what Buddhism would say, because practicing generosity, and you allow actually even people to come who cannot pay for their food, nor for their room, nor for the course, and they just come. And that's fantastic. It's really beautiful that this is not just available for the rich people. Okay? So we start to really take responsibility for the financial means that we have. You know, not asking how much is it worth. I mean, how much is bread worth? Come on, it keeps you alive. How could you ever really pay the price for bread or tomatoes? I hear they've gone up in price because they're rare. So like this. So you have to make these three kind of activities, yeah? Hearing, contemplating, meditating. Then slowly, the mind transforms, if you want. Then also what they talk about right at the beginning of the practice, to generate certain attitudes. Ooh, I could have put that in these 30 questions. I think I didn't. Six attitudes, because we keep forgetting about them. Yes, and then, you know, we have all these lists. You will see then in your Lam Rim outlines, like four of these, and three of that, and You know, three we already did, the hearing, contemplating, meditating. Now it would be six attitudes, but we'll talk maybe about three or four that are really important, also for non-Buddhists. Yeah, I can see the older students are all taking up their pencil. It's not the six preparatory practices for that you do before the meditation, so it's not those. But it's first one, anybody can guess or anybody knows? It's a really important one. It's the most important one. To learn, to wanting to transform the mind. So that you do make the steps of bearing the hardships of spiritual practice. Because it can be joy and fun, but that depends on you. It's not from the practice. It can be like terrible hardships, boring to death and whatever. So that again depends on you. So what's the first one? Huh? What's that? Not motivation? Huh?
Not motivation.
No? That's only two there, motivation, dedication. Yeah, good guess. Hmm? The antelope and the deer? No, I don't know. Or the cups, you mean, upside down?
No, that's the
dream. That's another one. No, to see yourself as a patient. To see yourself as a sick person. That's the first one. And that's the main one. Because, you know, if you just go to the doctor for a general checkup, you know, you're not really interested in what he has to say because you feel good. And many people come to these courses, we don't realize how crazy we are. We don't realize how mad we are. We don't realize how wrong we see reality. You know, we need somebody first to tell us, yeah? So maybe we're just like, so you go for a general checkup and then the doctor says, ooh, you know, you might not feel something, but something is waiting for you here, yeah? So then the interest is totally different and say, oh, what's wrong? And then the doctor says, this and this. So the second attitude is that we see the Buddha as the doctor. And the Buddha as a doctor in the sense of somebody who has had the same sickness and through found his own cure. Kind of he found what was the cause for the sickness, and the moment you find the cause and you're able to stop the cause, the sickness will stop. Otherwise, you know, you might swallow a lot of medicines, but if you don't stop the cause, it continues. So then this doctor says you have some, you know, really strange thing that nobody has ever heard about. Then you have two choices. Either you trust the doctor and you do what the doctor tells you to do, or you say, I don't feel anything. Why should I do something about this? And then you might have it and then you die, but you could have been healed. So to see that the Buddha as the doctor that we need because we're sick, you know, I mean, if you're sick, sometimes if you just have a cold, you know, it lasts a week, so then you can just wait and drink hot ginger, lemon, honey, and that's it. It doesn't make it go away, it's, you know, but still lasts 7 days, but it's, we at least we do something about this. And but if you have something that, you know, there's some pain or, you know, and you know, don't know what it is, you need somebody who has studied this to tell you what it is, isn't it? And this we understand, that we ourselves, we don't have the skills to heal ourselves. Yeah. To see the practice or the dharma, to see the dharma is the teachings, the methods, yeah? The methods that we are being given to transform the mind, to see this as the medicine, that's the third one. And the cure would be your practice. That's the fourth one. There's no point knowing everything about the medicine and then not swallowing it. Having it all there, you know, having studied where it comes from, how it's been put together and all this, knowing the effects and the side effects and la 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 la, but you never apply it. Meaning that when we talked about patience, you need difficult situations so you can practice patience. That's the practice, you know, or taking ourselves back a little bit and not always wanting what I want, or at least not noticing how much I always want what I want. I noticed it today, me, when I had decided to put the fruits not in the booth but on the seat, and then I put them on the seat, and then I even said, I said, oh man, am I stubborn? Gosh, you know, so this is the practice. The practice is not so much that you go against your grain and you force yourself to do things that you're not able to do, and then you know, or we fake that we're patient and inside it's boiling. It's not like this. Practice is more, we see what's going on. And we don't want, and we don't hide it anymore. That's also a big part of the practice. We're able to say, we're able to talk about this, we're able to, we start to get to know ourselves, how we inside, how we are. Okay? So seeing the practice to implement these things in our daily life, to see it as the cure. And then, then the two other ones, it's a bit difficult to understand, especially if you're not a Buddhist. Kind of you learn to see all the different Buddhas as one Buddha. Okay? All the Tathagatas are Shakyamuni Buddha. It doesn't matter which form they all have the same qualities. And then the wish for this to stay for a long time. This as a beginning attitude you can't really have. I don't know. Quite honestly, I don't know why it's in there. For me, the first four are really meaningful, why they are at the beginning of the text. The other two, I would say, they come as you practice, because you yourself, you will feel how helpful this is. So, of course, you want this to stay for a long time. And what's the best way to make the Buddha Dharma stay for a long time? What's the best way? Yeah, by being a good example. But that, so that people are inspired because of us and not go like, man, they become even stranger than where they were before. Yeah. So, and because there is in the teachings themselves, except for when it talks about emptiness, there is nothing that is really absolute truth. It's just relatively true, and it needs to know. You need to know what the Buddha wanted to say and to whom he said it. So this is why sometimes very difficult to understand sutras also. Because, you know, the Buddha is always pointing to the same moon. But he's pointing from different directions. Yeah, so if so what very often we only look at the fingers that are pointing at the moon instead of looking at the moon. So the moon, the goal, is a no goal. Isn't that fantastic to say these very intelligent things where I myself don't know what it means? Actually, to realize that there's no goal, that's the goal. So, but it's not a no goal, okay, then I don't do anything, goodbye, I'm going home, and I'm having a good time. You need to go through all these stages and through all these teachings in order to understand all of this is fake. There's no goal. Yeah, so that will be the goal. And then it's not finished. Then you will have developed your mind to its fullest potential. You will have universal compassion, universal wisdom, and universal skills, so that then you really know how to benefit others. And that is a good thing if that already comes right at the beginning. Even if at the beginning you only look after yourself first, because you want to get yourself well, you want to get yourself stable, you want to get yourself wise so that you can be of benefit to others. Yeah, so that's the first thing. First, I have to get my act together here, and then I will be of benefit to others. Because if we don't even know how to make ourselves happy, it's a bit of an illusion thinking we can do this for others, but we always think we can. You know, we're very often somebody comes and complains about something, and then we say, don't worry. That's usually what we say, isn't it? How many times do you use that for yourself? When you're in the middle of worries and what will happen and it's not going to go well, how many times do you apply this advice for yourself? Huh? Hardly ever. We go, huh? Oh, good. Perfect. But I guarantee you, most of the people, hardly ever. to tell ourselves.
Yeah.
So you never, so you worry and then you say, oh, don't worry. And okay, good. Perfect. Okay, so again now, you know, just so that we don't waste so much time, if somebody really never gets angry, you don't need to tell me, okay? This, do you see what I mean? So that you do it all the time, fantastic, I'm really happy, and I'm not being cynical, but you don't need to say, because you're quite an exception, I would say. Usually we get carried along with these worries about children, grandchildren, finances, this and this and this. I mean, how many times do you tell yourself, you know, don't worry, you might die before the bill comes. So then, you know, like realistic things. Huh? Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's like this whole thing about, you know, getting frustrated and being afraid and all this and going into the future again and again and again and thinking about all the negative things that can come. It's like it's really no point because we might, it doesn't help the situation. It just makes us upset and tight and nervous and all this. But very often we allow the mind to go down that lane again and again and again and again and again and again. But when other people are in that situation, we very quickly give them that advice. Don't worry, it will pass. You know, and don't worry, you've had more difficult situations. You overcame them. So we're quite wise when it comes to tell other people what they should do. This is what I'm trying to get at. To other people what to do. And we think they should be able to take this advice and totally transform their behavior, whereas we never use it, hardly ever use it for ourselves. So this is the whole thing about this Buddhist spiritual practice. You turn the whole thing around. Instead of telling others what to do first, you tell yourself. Okay? Right, so this one I will leave here, that at the end you can come and have a look at it. It's not running away, it's a spider, okay? It's plastic. It doesn't move, it doesn't jump. It's not one of these trick things to make you afraid or whatever. It's a hologram. It's an optical illusion, and you probably don't see anything because you don't have it at the right angle, whereas I see it. It's two mirrors, one here, one here. There's a hole on top, and the spider is inside. I took a spider because it's black and it's easy to see, and it's light, so it doesn't scratch the mirror. Please don't go with your finger where the mirror is, because it scratches it. They're very sensitive. But it creates an illusion. It creates the illusion that the mirror that is below is where actually the hole is. And then it protects the spider who is sitting on the bottom. It projects it up to the surface. Yeah, some of you might know it already. And it's a really, really good device to show how something can appear totally real, but is not there. How the mind, because of certain causes and conditions, if these two mirrors were not here, then you wouldn't see anything like that. That we can perceive something and totally believe in it that it's true, Until, if you're afraid of spiders, and I tell you, but don't worry, the spider is not here. You can really go with your finger and you won't touch anything. If I just say that, you know it intellectually, it's not enough for you to overcome the phobia of going there. Yeah. And sometimes even they go with the finger and they feel that the spider is not there, still they have problems going there. Yeah. Now, it's not really about this, it's about habits. It's about habits that we're stuck in an illusion and we totally believe in that illusion. And the Buddha, the word Buddha means awake. The Buddha is awake. We are not sleeping, we are dreaming. And we're in the middle of that dream and we haven't woken up yet. And the same as when you are dreaming, the dream becomes reality. It has the function of making you afraid or happy or angry or attached to yourself or to others, or you lose things, you're sad. Yeah, totally. It's as if it's reality, as long as you don't realize that it's not a dream. And you suffer. Yeah. And the moment you wake up in the morning, your heart might still go lit, boom, 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 boom. But when you go to the workplace and it was a really horrible dream and you tell the dream to somebody, you're not telling it as if that would really have happened to you. You laugh. And, the more horrible the dream was, the more you have fun in telling the story, isn't it? No, we're not going to, to tell our very boring dreams that we had lunch and then it was very nice and then we went to wash the dishes and then I woke up. You'd never tell such a dream. But if it's like, whoa, really dramatic, we have a lot of fun. And we're not carrying this along with us. Yeah, because we see that actually nothing happened. It only happened in the dream. All I needed to do is wake up. Okay? So this belief on a real me, I, or self is like believing that this spider is here. Okay? The self here arises because of ignorance, wrong view, because it appears and the appearance is not the problem. The problem is that we take it for real and then we try to defend it. So if you want to get rid of that spider up here and you only work with the spider that appears, you work and work and work, it will never go away. So we don't really need to do something with this so-called ego or I. We only have to recognize that it's not there. And it's not even sure that it will disappear, but we will see it as an appearance, the same way you will see that this is just a spider. Sometimes they use a different example. They use the Fata Morgana in the desert. You know, when they talk, Buddhists, the Tibetan Buddhists, they talk about view, meditation, action. These three steps, okay? The view is, if you've never seen a Fata Morgana and you're thirsty, over there is water. You're thirsty, what do? You go there, because you're thirsty. You get there, no water. Then again, you keep walking. Again a Fata Morgana, and again you run, and again you run, and again you run, and again you run. And maybe you will never find out that if nobody comes to explain to you that this Fata Morgana arises through the conditions of, heat and I don't know what, all these kinds of things, and an eye consciousness, an eye seeing the Fata Morgana. Yeah? If nobody sees the Fata Morgana, there is no Fata Morgana. You need an eye, a mind to perceive it. Yeah. It's very interesting, this question I ask people sometimes. When this thing is in the cupboard and nobody looks at it, is the spider on top or not? Don't know, yeah. If nobody looks at it in the right angle, the spider is definitely not on top there. Because he's not inherently here. He just is here because of the right causes and conditions, same way as the Fata Morgana. Yeah, we never have Fata Morganas in Switzerland. So then the meditation is kind of, somebody comes and says, hey man, look, you run and run and run, but this is not water, this is just an illusion. Yeah. So, but you still want to run, the same way when you're afraid of spiders, you still don't want to go there. And the same way as we, because we're so used to this I, me, we react every time somebody kind of touches it, with words or actions or whatever. We need to familiarize the mind that this not, it's not right. And then the action will be totally different. You will be in your dream and you will be having a lot of fun because it's just a dream. And then you can become Superwoman or Superman or whatever. You will have much more courage to act in your dream. And I would almost guarantee you would act with compassion and not with aggression. If you know that I can't risk anything, it's just a dream, I keep having this dream because I love water, that I'm underwater and then at the beginning I'm afraid to breathe because somehow I think it's true, so I know that I can't really breathe underwater because I'm a human. But then I have to continue breathing and I'm still dreaming. I think, oh wow, great, I can breathe underwater and I'm all happy, And then when I wake up, I go, did it again. Not realizing it's just a dream. Yeah. So the word Buddha means awake. Buddha, through these practices, through meditation, familiarizing the mind with all this, has has attained full awakening and then acts out of this space of awakening, you know. And we are dreaming and we mistake a lot of things. And I'm reading a book that is called The Heart Attack Sutra by Karl Brunholzl. He's an American, and he's a student, a disciple of Pöndlop Dzogchen Rinpoche. He's a great short commentary on the Heart Sutra, and he gives us there a few examples. For example, our compassion that we have for ourselves and for a few people, our loved ones, is like steam in a pressure cooker. So if you keep the pressure cooker closed, because our compassion can be limitless, but if we just use it for us and for others, it becomes so strong that it hurts. Same as the steam in the pressure cooker burns. You open the lid, okay? The steam goes out and it goes everywhere and it moistens instead of burning, because it's not just too much pressure on me and my family, it's for everybody. I thought it was a very, very nice example, because we have natural universal compassion, we would have it, but it is limited because of our limited mind kind of thing. And then it hurts, then the compassion that we have hurts instead of being healing and moistening like the steam that comes out of the pressure cooker. Okay. Is that more or less clear until now? Yeah? Are you very tired? It's 8:30. So it's not late yet, okay? I usually need to remind the people. Now, what we're working with, just a brief introduction what the mind is. You'll have a few more in your Lam Rim outlines. I put this in, it's not really in the Lam Rim, these teachings on the mind, because they come before the Lam Rim, the teachings on what mind is. But if you have no idea what the mind is, it's very difficult to understand what is being talked about. The mind is not the brain, okay? The mind uses the brain. It is said the mind is, by nature, hello?
Clear knowing.
Woo! Bravo! Very good. This, every Buddhist should, it should come like this. Clear and knowing. Clear in the sense it is not obstructive and it cannot be obstructed. And it's clear in the sense like a mirror that is totally clean and not distorted. Yeah? So it reflects whatever is there. And the mirror is not full, you know. Something else obstructive might obstruct it from seeing or from reflecting, you know, something like the wall. If that would be a mirror, the wall is obstructing from seeing objects outside. But it's not the mirror who is obstructed, it's the object itself out there. So it's clear in that sense. Also clear in the sense, maybe luminous, you know. The same way if we would come into this room and there's totally no light, for my mind, no object would exist in that room unless I bump into it. Yeah. And then the mind is like shining a light on it, making it clear, making it come into existence. And what we don't realize, one of the first things we don't realize, that there's nothing that exists apart from my mind. And that I cannot go out to experience the world. I cannot go out of my own mind to experience the world of Giddy. I only have my own mind. And the less dirty, we talk about, the mind becomes dirty or defiled when it is agitated through wrong views, which then create anger, attachment, aversion, jealousy, pride, desire, these kind of things. Okay, and then the way I perceive the world is not how I would perceive it if the mind is really calm. That the way I see the world is because of my habits, my opinions and the clarity of my mind. So that's the clarity part. Clear, and so it means it's not material. You might be able now with time, you know, to measure like waves or things like energy, might be able to measure it, I don't know, but it's not something that you could, I mean, until now, okay? Now with science, who knows what the neuroscience and all these people, what they will find out. The knowing part, it knows its object. And it can know its object wrongly. It can know a spider on top here, but it's just an appearance of spider. So knowing doesn't mean that it knows it the right way. It can know it in a mistaken way. It's also a kind of knowing. There's certain words that we just have to agree on, because otherwise, you know, for you, knowing might be something totally different. But when we talk about this, the mind, the definition of the mind, it is clear and knowing. It knows its object. And when we talk about mind, sometimes we talk also about consciousness. So that's the same thing. Whatever is mind is consciousness, whatever is consciousness is mind. And then we have six of these consciousnesses. Each one knows its object. And it needs an organ to be able to do that. So in order to hear, we need an ear that functions, because my left ear doesn't function anymore, so that one still looks like an ear, but is like nothing, I go like this, I can't hear anything. Yeah? It's quite weird at the beginning, actually, because it happened suddenly. So I don't hear anything, you know. Whereas here, I go, it makes like that sound. Yeah. So is that sound existing or not? Does that sound exist when I give the ear the conditions to hear the sound? No, because the consciousness is missing. Or the organ, consciousness might still be there, because here I hear, but here the supportive organ is not functioning. Okay, so we need a sound, which usually comes through contact or something, you know, makes waves. Then we need an ear that functions, and we need an ear consciousness that recognizes sound. Now these five sense consciousnesses, like ears for sound, eyes for form, shape and color, tongue for taste, like five different tastes, not pizza and ice cream, but like, you know, salty, sweet, astringent, bitter, what's the fifth one?
Sour,
exactly. These five, that's all the tongue recognizes. And then the brain makes all kinds of things out of them. It's very interesting to see when you try to taste what it is without seeing it. Or when you try to see what it is only touching it, not smelling and not, it's quite amazing. Yeah, how, I don't know if you remember, Leora, once in Tuval, you didn't have your glasses on and you thought it was bulgur, I think. And you tasted bulgur, because you even said it. It tasted like bulgur. Then she puts her glasses on and says, oh, but it's quinoa. And then it started to taste like quinoa. You see the power of the mind. So sometimes when you start with these practices and you really start to observe what is going on, you have these moments of, wow, the power of the mind. There's, you know, how it can change its object just by using another sense. Just having made up the mind is bulgur, it becomes bulgur. Then seeing it's quinoa, it becomes quinoa. Or me, I was in a center in Austria, they have no mirrors, and I was brushing my teeth in the morning, and I looked up and I saw my face on the wall, because I'm so one is so used to see the face when you look up from the sink. So for a few seconds I saw my face, and again I was like, wow, you know. So these are the moments when we start to understand on a very, very, very deep level. And these moments you should really savor them, and you should then remember them, you know. It's like, wow, the power of the mind. I see it like this, but maybe it's not like this. Okay? So that's the knowing part. So the five sense consciousnesses, one is body, is for touch, then tongue, nose, ear, eye. And then the sixth one is the mental consciousness. And now we have different views on that. If you know, you have different philosophies, Cargill, I'm not very familiar with, I have to admit, but they make like seven and then eight consciousnesses. the Gelug, the mental consciousness, okay, the mind, the mental consciousness, which doesn't have objects of touch, objects that are atomically established. They say that we have only, as an unenlightened being, and also not in deep meditation, you only have access to conceptual consciousness, mental consciousness. That's why we're stuck in the concepts. That's why we're actually not reacting on the actual thing, because you have the sense consciousness picks up an object, and you have a short moment of direct perception of, let's say, see something, form and color, and then I cannot help the mind, the mental consciousness, the conceptual consciousness, to jump in and put a label. I cannot prevent, either it's, I don't know what it is, that's already a label, or when we know, I look at things, and it goes unconscious, that it goes microphone, shoes, this, that, blah, blah. That would be more or less okay. Although, there is nothing that comes from this side that is watch. Nothing. It's the mind who puts watch. Only the mind. There's not one thing, but it looks as if it's coming from that side if you don't analyze. Okay? So this is what the mental conceptual consciousness is doing. It's giving labels. And the label makes the watch, because if I'm a dog, this is definitely not a watch. This is something totally uninteresting. Yeah? It's another object. I'm not saying it's not an object, but it's something totally different. So it depends again on the mind what it is. So it would be more or less okay. But then it adds more things that are not there. It adds inherent existence. And it mixes, it mixes the base and the label together somehow, which it doesn't make sense. Yeah? Because there's the label. But also, just the label watch, then you can't see what time it is. So you need also the base. So then if that all comes together, it becomes the watch. And it adds permanence. Top of it, It doesn't see that this thing is impermanent. Maybe it knows it intellectually. But if it breaks, even the battery, every time it stops, I go, oh. Although we all know perfectly well that batteries end, but when it shows the real nature, I go, I'm surprised. Oh. I can see maybe you do the same thing. Yeah. Or when, I know if I drop it really hard on stone, it will break. I go, oh, It's always the hope. While it's still in the air, it's always the, oh, shouldn't break. It meets something hard, it breaks. Okay, so this is what the mental consciousness is doing. And the mental conceptual consciousness is doing. And then it adds more things. Good, bad. I like, I don't like. And this is where all the problems are coming from. Because we like the wrong things. We like things to be easy, to be pleasant. Yeah, it's nice. But that's just about it. It doesn't make us stronger. It doesn't make us develop patience. It definitely doesn't make us to see the reality or the nature of the thing. And we get attached. Then we get attached to something that doesn't give us what we want. We want lasting happiness. What does it give us? Temporary happiness. On top of it, that temporary happiness is never enough. And then on top of it, we develop the habit that it becomes the purpose of our life to find pleasant moments. And this is then what we do with our life. Many people do that. And then we think that's a fulfilled life. But if you really look inside, is this really what I want to do with my life? You'll have a discussion group on this, I think, tomorrow. What's a meaningful life for you, But I'm not saying you shouldn't do this. If you are not creating negativities, if you're not stealing the money that you're spending, if nobody suffers from you running after pleasures, it's legal. It's not forbidden. It just doesn't give you what you want. Lasting happiness. So then when the mind in meditation comes deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper, then you will at one point have be able to access this, like the direct mental consciousness, and then we're okay. Because the purity of it and all the qualities, they're actually already there, because they're just covered. Yeah. So all we have to do is take the cover away. Like, in order for you to see the watch, well, from this side you can see it, but like from their side, okay? In order for you to see the watch, the watch is already here, but you don't know it, you don't see it. All I have to do is take this away. I don't need to put anything more in it. So this pure nature mind that one is trying to make, function, because we have moments sometimes of this pure nature mind. That we, this is why we practice to bring this out, to kind of, it's already there, to discover it, maybe that's a good way, so that it can function. That's the purpose of the practice. Okay? That this incredible potential that we have can then come to what? Function. That we can, then we can be of benefit to others. We will be happy. Happy is not the right word. We will be stable. We will be sober. We will be normal, actually. And normal in the sense of, because that's the norm, but normal in the sense of what we use it as normal, you know? Because a fully awakened mind, this is not for me. Also, most of the things I say, they're not for me. Sometimes I mention from whom they are. Sometimes... But everything I know because I learned it, not because I discovered it. So, and I'm glad I have these fantastic teachers who can say sometimes one sentence and then you understand. Tsongsa Kenzen Rinpoche, in his commentary in Germany on the Heart Sutra, he says, you know, sometimes people think an awakened mind is something high up there, really exotic, and but we all have it. And if you want to know what a fully awakened mind is, it's a mind that is at the height of its normality. We are all crazy and stupid. We're not normal. Because harming others is not normal. And when somebody harms us, we understand that it's not normal. Somebody harms you, you're not going around saying, yeah, well, you know, human beings are quite, they're angry and they're bad, and therefore, you know, harming me is normal, it's okay, why not me? When we harm others, we think like that. But when we are getting harmed, we understand that this is not normal. This is why we get hurt, you know, like, and we hold that being hurt. If it's normal, you know, I mean, if it rains and I go out and I get wet, it's normal. So I get wet and then I dry my clothes. I'm not feeling hurt that the rain now made me wet. I let go. I don't say, I'm not going to this country anymore. Once, you know, the rain, boo, it made me really wet. You know, and then I got a cold afterwards. I still let go because it's normal. I'm wet, it's cold, I get a cold, I'm sick, that's it. Yeah? So when we harm others, we think, well, it's normal. Of course, because they started it. When we get harmed, even if we started it, then it's not normal anymore. Being of benefit to others, being really connecting with others, understanding what's going on with them, you know, having so much empathy that you can open your mind and your heart in such a way that you really understand what this person is going through, that is normal, and that makes us feel good. Isn't it? And you see, why do we think feeling good is normal? Because it is normal. I mean, why is this thrive of feeling good so strong? Because it's normal. It's our birthright to feel well and to be happy. But because we don't understand that being well and being normal has causes, and we don't understand what hinders us to be able to live that, we do all kinds of stupid things. And so again, I'm not claiming that what the Buddha says is absolute truth. For me, it is true. I feel that when I act out of a space of compassion, I'm okay. I'm not like, wow, but I'm just okay. I'm calm, I'm quiet. I don't feel, I have no sleepless nights. Even if it was kind of strong compassion and I had to tell somebody, amen, you know, something maybe unpleasant sometimes. When I'm when I have moments where I dislike somebody, and I do have these moments, they're getting rarer and rarer and rarer, and really work with it, I feel terrible. I don't like to hurt people. It makes me, I feel I'm hurting myself, but sometimes, you know, the dislike is quite strong, and then there's nothing we can do about it. Have you ever noticed that? So when other people dislike us, we think that they're in control and they do it on purpose, instead of looking inside. When somebody comes in your, you know, pushes your buttons and makes you nervous, we have no control. We can't say stop. We can transform it slowly, slowly. We can go away from the person and do all these kinds of things. But at that moment, when, you know, when somebody pushes my buttons and it's like, it's there. And this is the practice to dissolve these things, to transform them, that make us also feel uncomfortable and definitely hurt others very much. Yeah. So you can, the best protection for you, not for other people not to be able to hurt you, is when you know they have no control. When you feel the sting of dislike in their behavior. That's the best way to protect yourself, and to put some truth in there is to see, wow, they're maybe just like me, because I don't like to dislike that person, but I do. And the more you can admit it, the more you have a chance that it will transform with time. And then there's less and less, less people who can push your buttons, okay? So this is the mind. And this mind, because it is not material matter, it continues life after life after life after life, together with these karmic imprints. We'll talk about karma, that are deposited on the mind like on a field, and then it goes. But the mind is not something material. So if you want to go to the subtlest level and you ask the Dalai Lama what is going on from life to life to life, he says, the merely labeled I. Now, very often it's better to talk at the beginning of a very subtle mind, or this you know, what's it called? The alaya, the storehouse. It's better to talk like this, because otherwise people get too confused. You know, you have to make the mind more subtle and more subtle and more subtle, so that then you can understand what it really is. What it says also in this heart attack sutra kind of thing, commentary, if the Buddha would have at the beginning taught about emptiness, people would have said, come on, you're crazy, and nobody would have listened. So that's why he said, he started his teachings by saying, there's the noble truth of true suffering, the noble truth of true origin of suffering, the noble truth of true cessation of suffering, and the noble truth of the path to do something with the suffering. If he would have said from the beginning, hey guys, come on, there is no suffering, there's no origin, there's no cessation, there's no path, nobody would have understood what he would have said. Okay, so that's why he went quite solid with the four noble truths at the beginning. So it is said that this mind goes life after life after life, reincarnates according to what is being activated at the time of death. We'll talk about this. I will tell you the theory about this, then you can either accept or not accept, but at least then you know the Buddhist view. And this mind can be cleaned, because by nature it is clean. The same as water. Water is always transparent. There can be dirt in the water, sand, but you can take it out. Yeah. And the mind is not, the clear nature mind, the clear light mind, clear nature mind, is not mixed with these negative mental factors. Okay? So on the on page 2 of your Lamrim outlines, you have like how in Buddhism these mental factors are explained. But don't be afraid, I'm not going through that. This is just, if you get at one point you come across the things, this list might be helpful. Okay? And what I forgot to put there is the six main consciousnesses, actually. So I just talk about mental factors. So we have these six main consciousnesses, and in them are what is called mental factors that flavor or color that mind moment. Okay, like if I put something red behind the transparent water. The water will appear, they usually use a crystal. The crystal becomes red, like that. Yeah. So we can have positive mental factors in the mind. The mind becomes positive. We'll talk more about these when we come to the delusions. This is just kind of an introduction. We can have negative mental states, then that creates negative karma also, makes us unhappy. And we have certain factors that are always there so that we can perceive. It's the first five ones: intention, contact, feeling, recognition, and attention. And then we have mental factors that are changeable. They're neutral, kind of. Depends what kind of motivation that you have. Okay, so how about we do short meditation on the mind? And then you can go to sleep, because I can see you going low. And there's not much point then to continue. I think for you the main point tonight, to just recapitulate, the mind, the definition of mind, clear and knowing. And the mind is not the brain. The mind uses the brain, but it's not the brain. Okay. You can turn off the lights. The eyes will get used to it, because it's too bright to meditate. Tomorrow morning, I forgot to say something. You will hear sometimes in the morning or in the evening or at any time of the day either Liora or me chanting and playing some kind of drum. It's a very profound Tibetan Buddhist practice. Please don't get upset. We are just doing our practices. We will not explain what it means, because it is so profound also. But so that you know, nobody has gone crazy or is strange, doing strange things, whatever. It is part of Tibetan Buddhist practice to do these rituals, to do the, you know, some chanting and all this. If it disturbs you, then go away, you know. I will probably, if I do the morning and evening practices, which are without the drum, I'll do them down in the Japanese garden. So I hope I will not disturb you if you're sitting there contemplating something. Otherwise, there's plenty of other spaces for you to go if it's disturbing. Did I have to say something more? I can't remember. The silence you mentioned, yeah, we do half silence the first 2 days, then full silence the last time. And by the way, the definition of silence is not talking. It's not talking when Losang is not looking. Okay? So please, it's very helpful for your practice. If you're new, this might be uncomfortable because you've never done it, especially if you are with other people in the room, but it is so relaxing. And for the people who are organizing the retreat also, if there's still things to organize, you know, you with the meditations or something, for this retreat, that's fine, but don't organize the next retreats already. You can let go. This will do when it's time to do them. So also for you, as much as possible, keep silent, because it's very restful. We lose a lot of energy by talking, so and you don't have to be anybody special, you know. So it's great. Everybody is the same. Nobody is stupid. Nobody is clever. Nobody knows more than others. You can just be yourself. So we start the silence tonight before we go to sleep. Okay? Thanks. So try to make yourselves comfortable, but with a straight back. Try to be at ease. Not to worry about anything. You know, if you hear these things about the mind for the first time, if you didn't understand, it's perfectly okay. It's perfectly normal. It's quite a profound thing, and that's, even though we all know that our well-being, our happiness, our sorrow, our grief, our anger, our love, our compassion do depend on the mind, yet we know so little about it and we put so little effort into getting to know it. So the first thing that we try to detect or to find is this very, very, very deep yearning that we all have for well-being, happiness, space, purity, goodness, and whatever other words you will want to use. It's a pulling. It's almost a bit of a sad feeling, something a little bit nostalgic. As if we lost something that we know is ours. It's difficult to define, so just get in touch with it. The yearning for goodness, well-being, purity, peace, and space, and many other things. And one could say that this is the nature of our pure mind calling us, trying to manifest, trying to say, you could have all these things. If you understand the hindrances to its appearance of purity, goodness, space, peace, and so forth. So then just if you still have enough energy and you're still kind of clear enough, turn your attention towards the mind. We cannot see the clear nature of the mind, but we can see the activity of the mind. Try to see it as if you're watching a movie or watching TV, as an observer, which is also a part of the mind itself. It's not the eye that is observing, it's awareness or mindfulness. And see the activity in there. You can hear my voice, or the air conditioner. And you have been sitting on the ground or on a chair since 7 o'clock. How much of this were you aware of? So become aware of that now, the contact the body is making to the ground or to the chair. Maybe you can feel rough or smooth or hot or cold. Try to detect the smell. A taste in your mouth. So these would be the perceptions that come in through our senses. And then you can see that not only that, we have feelings of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Or you can ask yourself, is there happiness, unhappiness, or neither at the moment present in the mind? Don't manipulate anything, just look. So usually a pleasant feeling would create some happiness as an emotion. An unpleasant feeling, we get tense and we push it away. So it creates an unhappy feeling, unhappiness. And then we have all the thoughts, all the stories running through the mind. Maybe just for a short time, wonder, where do they come from? Where are they going to? How do they arise? How do they disappear? And then just sit with that experience of looking at your mind. See how one moment of mind leads to the next, and the next, and the next, and how flexible the mind is, how much is going on, and we're hardly ever there. Perception creates a feeling, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Then the mind reacts with either happiness or unhappiness, and then the opinion about the whole thing. Like a commentator on a radio, giving a comment to everything, having an opinion about everything. These thoughts, hardly ever quiet. So just try to be with that process to get a bit of an intimate feeling of what mind actually is. It's not one solid thing. We cannot recognize the mind, we can recognize its activity as if we're seeing the water because of the waves that it makes. So don't give yourself any answers, just keep with the questions, you know? The contact, the body to the floor. What is it that is experiencing that? What is a feeling of contact? What is a sound? When it comes in through the ear, does it mean that it's inside the body or what? A smell? Same thing. We're just here to ask questions. We're not giving ourselves any answers. We just observe with a lot of curiosity. If you're totally confused, could be, doesn't matter, then just stay with that confusion. Just watch it. How does it feel? Okay, then we can very slowly bring this very short contemplation on the mind or the functions of the mind to an end by now actively thinking that the fruits of my time here or of my spiritual practice may be, of course, of benefit to myself, but may it also be of benefit to others. May I be able to develop a good heart? May I be able to connect with others the way I would like others to connect to me? May I be able to understand the causes of suffering and the causes of cessation for suffering? Thanks to our practice, the supreme mind of non-violence that has not arisen, arise and grow. And may that which has arisen increase forevermore. Okay, I don't know if Kitty has talked about the prostrations. Not really. Okay, so basically this is really a practice for people who, because it's prostrations, and I know from your tradition you shouldn't prostrate, and you don't have to come, okay? It's like, it's totally optional. It's really, I mean, it's really prostrating physically to the holy objects there, but what we're prostrating to is actually our own potential to bring that up. That's the best prostration that you can do when we talk about refuge. If you can take refuge in your own Buddha nature, that would be the most powerful. So we're not bowing to idols or anything like this. We're bowing to the fully enlightened Buddha that we can then also fully awaken. So that is the purpose we do that. It's a purification practice to purify negative karma. If you want to do it, if you want to do it but you don't know how to do it, you need to come 5:45. I'll be here. I'll come at 5:45. I'll explain a little bit how this is done, because, you know, people don't want to come. It's perfectly fine. It's really people who, if you're curious, then that's fine. But it's like, yeah, if you know that there's a need to purify and you really want to purify, it's one of a very strong purification practice. It's kind of Buddhist yoga kind of thing. It has to be done, you know, it has to be done correctly also. I can't do it anymore because of my knees. And so if you're still young enough, this is for the Buddhists and for the practicing Buddhists, and do it, because you might not be. I really miss that practice in the morning to do. So and it's a good way to start the day also. So if you want some explanation on it, then please come 5:45. I will be here. I will explain. Then since I'm already here, I can also lead it. And then the other two mornings, I found a text. You got one? Anyway, text is here. But since I'm here, maybe it's on the computer, but since I'm here, then, you know, now we're not going to look for it. We can look tomorrow during the day. Everybody's tired. We're going to sleep. So it's a Buddhist practice that is practiced a lot, but you don't have to do it if you don't want to do it. That's totally optional. So then, if you don't want to do it, then you just come for 7:30, isn't it? That's right. 6:30. Yeah, 6:30, and then there's the meditation that Shoshana will lead. Okay? With giving you instructions how to sit and what to do, what not to do, and all this. Okay? The more simple you can be in your meditation, the more successful you will be. So don't try to achieve anything. You know, it's like just let go. And just be assured, even though it seems very, very long, until now, also for me, every meditation has always finished at one point. There's not to worry. Yeah. Okay, so good night, everybody. Sleep well. The silence starts now. And as I said, silence means not talking. If you really need to ask something urgently, then maybe write it on a paper, because then otherwise very quickly we go into talking. For these texts, what shall we do? Because, you know, one tries to treat texts, because it's the means to attain full awakening, as respectfully as possible. So we usually don't leave them lying either on the floor, especially not when people then walk over them. They're quite small. How about you take them to your room and you bring them again tomorrow morning for the class? Not for the meditation, you don't need, but for the class. And as I said, you can keep them, you can make notes. If you do not want to take them to your room, then just put them on a chair there, or on the mattresses as you go out, and then take it again tomorrow morning, or on a windowsill or somewhere. But let's try to be mindful and respectful, and not to let them lie on the floor. It's not, you know, if you step on them or whatever, you're not harming the text, you're not harming the Buddha, you're not harming the Dharma. It's kind of, it's just for us to show some respect. And respect is a beautiful mind, because whatever you respect, you will not be able to harm that object, be it the person or whatever else. Yeah, so, and we don't put that much effort into developing it. We have lost it a little bit, the practice of paying, showing respect. But it's a very, very nice mind. It really decreases the ego if we do this. And since that seems to be the purpose, then let's do it. Okay. Good night.